Hello and welcome. My name is Darren Russell and I'm just your average creator. On this show, I talk to people from all walks of life about how they use creativity in everything from business through the hobbies to inspire you, the audience, to get out there, dream big, get creative.
Episode 5, bringing toys into the future with tech.
I'm here with Bethany Kobe, CEO of Tech Will Save Us. And how are you going?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good, thanks. Tell us a bit about yourself and sort of what you do.
So I'm the founder and CEO of a organization called Tech Will Save Us, as you said, and we basically make experiences for kids to learn how to build things with technology and ultimately learn skills and have hopefully a lot of fun understanding that they can create and be creative with technology, not just consume technology.
Yeah, very cool. Can you give us sort of a sense of the size, like how many kits you sold last year or something like that, just an idea of how you've grown?
Yeah, so we've doubled in size kind of year on year, pretty much since we started. I mean, we've sold basically hundreds of thousands of kits last year. And we, you know, we grew our kind of digital kind of channel almost 70% last year, which was really exciting for us. We launched 7 new products last year as well, was the most products. Yeah, the most products we've ever launched in the history of the business. and we also launched our first subscription last year as well. So that's also a very exciting, kind of new offering that we're now exploring.
Yeah, that's very cool. That's the Inventors Kit, right?
Yeah, Future Inventors Kit.
Yeah, nice. So what are you doing with that kit?
Yeah, so we, I think, you know, the most important thing for us is that we are helping our customers. So we have customers and we have users. Our customers are usually the parents or a kind of an adult that wants to inspire a young person through these kinds of experiences. And then the user is obviously a young person, and we have different age groups. So we have 4 to 6 year olds, 7 to 10 year olds, and then we have 11 plus. And for every different age group, we have a kind of set of kind of developmental things that we want to really help kids to kind of explore, a set of skills and knowledge, kind of which we call our curriculum, which we want to introduce kids to and have them, again, explore and discover through their kind of creative process. And then we have a bunch of, you know, physical and digital kind of products that introduce these experiences to them. And the subscription that we launched is for the oldest age group. It's for the 11 plus age group. And for that age group, the insight that we, I guess, found that we were most excited about is, you know, kids at that age really want to make an impact in the world. They're, you know, almost kind of activists by nature, because of what's happening in the world, because of what they're learning in school, because of the challenges that they're facing. Kids just naturally want to make things better, and they know what's happening around the climate, and they know what's happening with animals, and they know what's happening with food, and it can be quite overwhelming. And so we really wanted to create a kind of experience that would allow them to have a portfolio of kind of things that they've explored, really focused on new technologies. So we used one of our best-selling products, which was a product that we developed with the BBC a couple years ago called the Microbit, which is like a little pocket-sized computer that you can do almost anything with. It's like the Swiss Army knife of kind of technology. And we created essentially a subscription offering where every month a young person is introduced to a kind of future-facing technology, whether that's things like gaming or AI or wearables or robotics or energy. They're able to explore a kind of theme and a concept and learn a bunch of skills and create some outcomes that introduce them to this kind of future-facing kind of scenario. So it's a really wonderful thing. It's really well designed. The outcomes are super fun. Yeah. They're familiar. They're not like so abstract that you're like, why would I want to do that? You know, they're cool. You want to make them. So yeah, so we're really excited about that as an offering.
Yeah, that's a really cool sort of concept. And so are you producing new stuff every month kind of thing? Like,
Yeah, so we have, I mean, the thing that's interesting about our business is because we're a range business, we have a range of products and we have, yes, you know, thousands of hours of content and projects. So some of the projects are completely new and some right. of them are actually projects that we've had in the past or, you know, things that have been made by kids already. And we've Got kind it. Of kitified them and refined them to make them more useful and the outcomes slightly more sophisticated. Easier. Some of it is not like new from scratch. It's kind Got of it. Evolved from stuff that kids have done already.
But I think that's awesome, like feeding in like the community, basically, like taking what the mm-hmm. kids are doing, because obviously what they're doing, other kids are going to enjoy as well. So I think that's a really smart way of utilizing your customers or users, actually. So that's good.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, we think so too.
Okay, so from what I can tell, it looks like the last time you raised capital maybe for the business was like 2018, just from what I could see mm-hmm. online. To me, that sort of seems like things are running pretty smoothly. Like, you know, it's been a couple of years now. Is that a pretty fair thing to say?
I mean, things are always exciting in a startup. I mean, I think, yeah, so we did, we raised a couple of years ago, and we raised some really exciting investors, including one called Bright Eye Ventures, who are a really wonderful fund focused on education.
Oh, great.
So that's been really useful in us really developing our education offer. So historically, we've really focused mainly on parents and on at-home kind of making. Yeah. And what we have now done is developed a collection of education boxes, which is a really great kind of new offering really specifically help teachers, after school clubs, you know, CSR programs to really utilize the kind of, you know, experiences that we've created across their curriculum. So, so things have been good in terms of, you know, there's been a lot of amazing and important learning, I think, that we've had, particularly in the last 12 months.
Right.
You know, around the new products, around the, you know, kind of growth of our digital channels. We've really just kind of embedded a lot of learning in the business. And there are also things, you know, that are still really hard. Like
yeah.
things changed dramatically in 2018 when Toys R Us went out of business. And, yeah. you know, that just changed the landscape, I think, more significantly than maybe anyone anticipated.
Right.
You know, the toy industry is going through tons of changes as well. You know, people are demanding, you know, less wasteful products from big organizations. So they're starting to do more kind of sustainable processes, which is amazing. And
yeah.
yet there are, you know, there are still products on the market that are, excuse my language, but like pretty shitty, you know, that are the best selling product of the year because, you know, they're kind of crazy and funny and kids want
yeah.
it, but it's basically a bunch of plastic in a box
yeah.
that becomes landfill next year. So It's still an interesting space to be in, and there's still challenges, but
yeah.
we have definitely learned a lot in the last 12 months that I think have made us a better organization, a more sustainable organization, and really utilizing the kind of data, the insights, the access we have to customers and our community in really, really good ways. So
yeah, that's awesome. And on the toy industry, do you feel like it's improved at all in the last few years, or do you sort of see a lot of the same going forward? Like, I've noticed some other people doing like more buildy, engaging stuff, but still not mm. a huge amount. Like, I think mm. you, like, when I first came across you guys around 2015, like, it was the first mm. I'd seen anything like that, and I thought it was very cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's a wide question. Like, has it improved? I mean, there's so many dimensions to improve. I think it hasn't changed enough.
Right.
I think there are parts of the industry that have become less old school and less porous and more agile and more interesting. And
right.
there's a whole bunch of it that's still really, really, really old school and really dated and, quite frankly, perpetuating behaviors and consumptive behaviors around parents and kids that are just like terrible. So.
Yeah.
Like, I still think the industry has a lot to do to change. And quite frankly, there's just still a lot of like terrible stuff being made. And large organizations that are like literally act like dinosaurs,
yeah.
Which is just, I mean, literally,
right?
I mean, I've been to some of these places and you're just like, wow, like what, how do you make anything? And no wonder our kids are being bombarded with all this crap all the time. And you have such bizarre choices because these organizations are run in power stalls and completely irrelevant, no access to their customers. And so, you know, the industry is still really old school. The things that have changed, that have improved, I think there is an imperative now for organizations to come up with ways of being less wasteful. And you see this with Lego, you know, making their blocks out of cornstarch in the future. And, you know, there's like recycling programs. And I think these things are, because these organizations want to be relevant and they will, customers will demand it. And the organizations that are smart will find ways of making it a part of their brand and business.
Yeah.
I think that there's more, there's more STEM and STEAM stuff everywhere, which you could say is good in the sense that there's an awareness of creating products that have value beyond just, you know, just fun, you know, and fun is important for sure.
Yeah.
But fun coupled with learning or fun coupled with something that has a bit more meaning is just exponentially better. So you could say that that's good in the sense that these organizations are seeing it as an opportunity. It's not so good in that a lot of it isn't really STEM or STEAM at all. It's like pretend STEM, or my team calls it faux STEM. So, you know, I think I think on the other side, there is not a toy organization in the world that isn't trying to understand how they get closer to their customer and create more direct relationships with their customers.
Yeah.
I don't know that that's improvement. I think it's more of a desire. And I think it's going to take some of them, you know, years to restructure their organizations and actually attract the kind of talent they need to even really, like, undo the retail monopoly that they currently have.
Yeah, for sure. So
a bit of a rant, sorry.
No, that's all right. It just broke up a little bit on us. Is that your goal with Techwell Services, just to educate and to inspire, or like, do you have like a message or an aim?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the business has had a kind of mission since we started, and quite frankly, the mission actually hasn't changed that much since we started the business. It's, you know, it's tweaked and the language has changed.
Right.
A little bit, but it, you know, it really hasn't, you know, dramatically shifted. You know, our kind of mission is to really offer what we call future focused families. These are our customers, products that allow their kids to have these experiences building with technology that are fun first, but ultimately offer those kids learning advantages. And the reason we call them learning advantages is because, you know, this is about kids having access to skills and knowledge and experiences that will ultimately help them to make better choices in the future, or to help them to identify confidence and capacity that they may never have known that they had, because if you've never done something, you just don't know.
Yeah.
So that's really, you know, the mission has always been about that. And I just think that the world has moved closer to kind of that mission. You know, there's an awareness around STEM and STEAM globally that, you know, even 5 years ago, just no one even knew what it was. There isn't a government in the world that hasn't put it on the curriculum as part of pretty much all mandatory curriculum has some kind of computer science connected to it now.
Right.
And kids now understand that they have the capacity to do things like programming, which again, even just 5 years ago, programming was for, you know, geeky adults that were going to become engineers, not for a 14-year-old girl that wants to like invent something for her room, or even create a gift for someone, or actually build, you know, a business or create a product. It just wasn't even thought of that was possible. So,
yeah,
you know, the world has changed, and that's great, because our mission, I think, is even more relevant and more, it, you know, echoes with more people now.
Yeah, no, that's for sure. I think it's very, it's a good timing, and I think everything's working in that direction for sure. So one thing I was just thinking about is something that's sort of become a little bit more poignant in today's society is like things like digital literacy, in the sense of like avoiding like fake news and how to exist in a digital society and a digital world. Like, have you thought about any way that you could also tie some of that education side into your products or anything like that to sort of help them figure out how to exist in this kind of digital society?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think there's the digital literacy is a kind of wide topic.
Yeah.
Because society is not equal, you know, as much as we'd like to believe that it is, there are still many people living in, you know, just down the street from me in London that, you know, are do not have access to the internet or do not have access to technology at home. They all have phones for sure, but they may not have access to technology in the same way that some other people might have, literally just a couple miles away from them. And, you know, and that's not even talking about, you know, kids or families that are in the developing world and have no access to certain things. So, you know, it's hard to generalize in terms of like digital literacy because it's so wide.
Sure.
And we've made a decision as an organization that like, you know, you really have to focus. You have to focus on something and you have to do it really, really well because we can't be everything to everyone. There are some amazing organizations like .everyone that's really focused on things like digital literacy around, you know, safety, around how to use the internet, around how to use data, around, you know, so there are amazing organizations like that. And that's not to say that some of those themes and topics don't naturally find themselves in the work we do, but we're not a business that's trying to teach that.
Gotcha.
We're an organization that's trying to create things that are super fun for kids that they do because they want to, not because someone's trying to educate them, not because someone's trying to teach them how to be safe. It's because they want to. And ultimately that really fun experience happens to teach them what electricity is and how it works or how to make circuits or how to program a game. Or the fact that, you know, a guitar and the electricity used in a guitar actually can vibrate and create an amplifier, right? So they're learning stuff because it's fun, not because someone's teaching them it.
Yeah, I think that's powerful. I think that's very powerful.
So in that process, they might learn things like that, or we might choose to actually, as we develop the business, to pick a topic that we think is, you know, really important that we want to kind of kidify and put kind of a kind of theme and curriculum around it. But we're not in the world to kind of do digital literacy as I understand it.
Gotcha. Yeah, no, that makes sense. So now going back a little bit, you guys started in 2012. What was that aha moment, the light bulb that went off that sort of made you go down this crazy adventure of a startup?
Mm-hmm. So I think there was, like every, I guess, founding story, there were like a few moments. It wasn't just like one moment. I think the first one was I did a master's in responsibility and business practice, which really kind of changed my, I guess, my understanding of my career and my practice. So I'm a designer by training, and doing that master's really opened my eyes up to something that I've always been really interested in, which is essentially around, you know, I really believe that business and enterprise, its role in society is to contribute and to solve problems. I really believe that fundamentally. And so the idea of starting a business was really exciting to me, not because I'm, you know, really passionate about, you know, like org charts and and like, you know, that kind of thing, although I do love org charts now, but because I fundamentally believe that business is one of the most powerful tools for creating impact in society. I really, really believe that. So yeah. I think that was one kind of spark that really started to get me thinking about like, could I start an organization? Like, what would it be? What would it solve? And then I think the kind of light bulb moments, if you will, there were kind of three of them. One was my husband, who's also my co-founder, and I, we found a laptop in a trash can near our house.
Yeah.
And it was one of those moments where like we found it accidentally. We weren't like, you know, dumpster diving. We were literally just like saw this bag with a laptop in it in our trash, and we took it out, and my husband, you know, looked at it, and we took it out and we cleaned it up, and it was a perfectly good laptop with a new install of Windows. It just, someone didn't want it, and so they threw it away. And we had this moment where we were like, yeah, we were like, that's just weird. Our relationship to technology is very flawed. And our conclusion from that experience was, it's because we just don't understand it. To that person, it was a black box that he had no use for, she had no use for. He didn't understand what they could do with it, what someone else might be able to do with it, because quite frankly, they just didn't understand it. And our relationship is just flawed because we just don't understand it. And quite frankly, it's designed for obsolescence right now. Right. So that was the kind of first thing. The second thing was, I come from a Montessori background. My mom owned a Montessori school my whole life. And so, you know, coming from that background, I had also taught lots of different workshops. My husband was teaching physical computing. We were just very aware that education is not moving fast enough to keep up with the pace of technology. That, you know, computer science is finally on the curriculum, but quite frankly, it should have been on the curriculum like 10 years ago, right?
Yeah,
to keep
sure.
up with where society needs it to be. And, you know, it's no one's fault. It just, technology moves at a pace that no one can keep up with. Government can't. How could something as complex as education do that? And so we really kind of thought about, well, how are you going to make this change that these generations need if education is just never going to be able to keep up with the pace of what's happening? Yeah. And then the last, maybe most important thing was, I had my first child. Mm. And, you know, becoming a mom is this amazing, overwhelming, wonderful experience. And I went to the toy department probably for the first time since I was a child.
Right.
And I was really depressed. It was very... It was very uninspiring. It just felt like, specifically around technology at the time, it felt like that industry just had no idea what was going on, and that it was presenting this generation, which is going to be the generation that literally does more than we ever did with technology, these archaic experiences with technology that were uninspiring, were not creative at all, and basically was assuming that they would not be able to do anything with technology. And so, and it was also gendered. I mean, don't get me started on the pink and blue aisle. And the, you know, it's changing, but like, really, it's 2020 and that's still how we sell products to children. I mean, so I was just totally shocked and disappointed. And that was really when we decided, all right, let's see if we can build an organization that can fundamentally impact the next generation with skills and experiences that could potentially help them to really create impact in the world in the future in ways that they just might not be able to otherwise.
Right. And that's, I think they're all good points, and I can totally see why you're like, I need to do this. And it was more just like to solve a problem. Did you think you were going to start a business before that? Like, apart from like, I know you said in your master's program, it sort of gave you the idea that you could change the world if you go down this path, but were you already starting to think of that?
No. I came from a family of entrepreneurs. My parents owned businesses, my grandparents owned businesses, my aunts owned, but like everyone was either self-employed or owned businesses. Right. And I come from a really creative family as well. And so I think I was like, I'm not doing that. I'm going to get a job and I'm going to get paid. And
paycheck.
And I'm going to like, you know, work in an organization and like have lots of people like, you know, that I'm working with.
Yeah.
So I don't think it was, not that I didn't want to. I just think I almost, because I grew up in it, was like, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
I'm going to do something else.
Rebellious thing. I go the other way.
Yeah. So no, I did not. I really didn't think I was going to start a business. And here I am.
It's like, what, 8 years in now? So,
well, we started doing workshops in 2012. So we didn't officially start like the business as you know it until 2015.
Got it. Interesting. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I've sort of admired about your company from the time that I've seen it is your intentional focus to partner with larger brands like the BBC, and I've also seen like Google and now Disney with some of your Avengers products. Was that kind of a strategy from the beginning, or did it sort of evolve over time?
So I think from the beginning, we always believed that there was really interesting partnership strategy in the business. I think our focus was always on being an experience business and not a character business. Okay. So, you know, a lot of toy businesses or kind of kids businesses start with a character, which I understand why. You know, and some of the most successful organizations are, you know, these character driven organizations. So that just wasn't our approach. Our approach was about experiences. And so we believed that in that we could also partner with lots of amazing organizations that were character businesses or were narrative businesses. And that we could almost leverage some of those amazing things that were probably bigger than us and probably had way bigger audiences than us to help us grow. So yes, there was always a thought that that could be the case, but I also think that we had to wait until we had enough foundation to be able to do things like that. So it was always a part of the plan, or at least part of what we hoped could be the plan. And then we finally got to a point where there were opportunities and we had enough foundation to be able to really start to explore what that might look like. And by no means do I think we're done exploring that. I think there will be more things like that as we grow in the future, for sure.
Yeah. And like, so you started with workshops in 2012. When was like the sort of the BBC partnership? When did that sort of start? Like, did it take you a long time to get them on board, or and how did you sort of maintain those relationships? Because it seems like they're going quite well.
Yeah. So the BBC thing started, actually, they came to us. In both cases, actually, Disney and BBC came to us. So BBC contacted us, I think it was like 2016, maybe 17,
right.
17, and invited us to come to BBC headquarters with like Arm and Samsung and Raspberry Pi and like 12 lawyers. And basically had this discussion where they decided that they were, you know, I don't know how much you know about the BBC, but the BBC reaches 98% of the UK population.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
It's an incredible organization. And there is really nothing like it in the world. And because it's a public kind of a company that serves the public, it kind of almost behaves more like a government than it does a private organization. So it has a remit to serve the public good.
Right.
And so every year the BBC has a theme that they use to kind of guide programming and guide activities. And the theme that they were going to launch in 2017 was about digital creativity, which was amazing. We were like, that's great.
Yeah.
And as part of that, they had this idea to basically launch a product that was like the BBC Micro that they had launched in the 80s, but for the next generation. So the Micro in the 80s, or the BBC Micro in the 80s, most people in the UK or any computer scientist knows about it because it was the first personal computer that most engineers learned how to program on. So everyone had these very fond memories of this, you know, kind of gray, you know, computer that, you know, you typed in, you know, into the kind of, you know, the mainframe, like, you know, the kind of keys. And it was a very kind of old school way of learning programming, but it was the way that most engineers learned programming. So all the ARM engineers and Microsoft engineers all learned programming on a Micro.
Oh.
Obviously that's not what a 8-year-old, you know, girl is interested in doing right now. So they had this idea to basically partner in order to develop the product. They didn't want to do it on their own. They wanted to, what they called, shine a spotlight on the amazing organizations that were already doing things in this world, and not walk in, you know, to the UK and say, hey, we solved the problem, but rather partner with all the amazing organizations that were doing things in different ways. Because there are places like Code Club, there are individuals like ARM that are making chips, that are making it possible to create products that are $20 or 15 or even less, right? Like, we couldn't do that without people like ARM.
For sure.
So they partnered with all these amazing organizations and they invited us to be part of this partnership. And our role in the partnership was to design the kit experience. So to design, you know, to, you know, we really represented the young person in the process. So a lot of times when you're, you know, ARM doesn't really have a customer, right? ARM develops chips. So They're like wanting to like put all this amazing technology in it. And we're like, yeah, but who's going to use it? And they're like, well, you know, maybe someone's going to build this. And if like 0.00001% of kids are going to use it, take it out, right? Like don't put it in because it's just going to add cost.
Right.
So it was an amazing partnership. The BBC did an absolutely incredible job facilitating what I can only describe as the most complex product development process in history, because it's hard enough developing a product by yourself, let alone with like major organizations. And the product ultimately was given to 1 million kids for free in the UK, which was incredible.
That's awesome.
And now the Microbit Foundation facilitated might be given to, you know, hundreds of thousands of kids around the world through partnerships with governments, through, you know, direct access with teachers and other partnerships as well. So the legacy of that kind of partnership lives on through the foundation, which is really amazing.
Right. That's awesome. And I think it's and a testament to what you guys are doing that these brands or companies are coming to you to partner, like BBC and Disney. They're not small fries, like they're some of the biggest organizations in the world. So
yeah, I mean, we feel the same way. We feel quite proud that, you know, we do something hopefully so unique and so well that we're seen to have a value that's different from what other organizations that they partner with are. You know, we're not better. Right. We're just different than, I think, what, you know, a traditional toy brand does or old school science businesses do or, you know, some of the online electronic stores, you know. A mom, you know, sitting at home with her, you know, three kids is not going to Farnell to buy a Raspberry Pi. Most moms, at least, are not.
Yeah.
Because it's impossible to navigate and it's hard and confusing. And so we hope to be more accessible than that.
So people learn in different ways. So like, you know, some people through play and tactile. Have you sort of developed ways to sort of encompass all like the ways that people learn? So like sort of audio or through touch or like sort of walk me through your philosophy of like the education side.
So the main kind of pedagogy, as we call it, like the main approach to learning is learning by doing.
Right.
So that's our main foundation. And we believe that everyone, whether you're auditory or visual or tactile, whatever, learns great by doing, by actually trying something, seeing if it works, and then, you know, figuring it out from there. The way in which we introduce those things, which, you know, to get a bit technical, we call kind of scaffolding. It's the ways in which we give people information is varied. And our approach is immersive. And I know that sounds really vague, but it's immersive. So we have videos, we have, you know, lots of animated GIFs, we have step-by-step manuals, we have a whole array of kind of content-based material that are different ways that different kids might want to approach how they get into these things. Some kids love video content and watch videos and want to, you know, watch the whole video and then try it. Other kids want to pause the video, do it, pause it, do it, pause it, do it. Others just listen to it while they're doing it. Others really like the step-by-step kind of more manual like tutorial. So we have a whole different collection and a whole array of different kinds of materials that go with our products. And because we have a digital platform, we don't put manual, like printed manuals in our boxes.
Oh, good.
You go onto a digital platform and all of your materials are there digitally. Because we do it that way, one, we save a ton of paper, first and foremost. What most importantly, we can iterate. We can see how things are being used. If we're finding that there's friction in how things are being used by lots and lots of people, we can investigate it and improve it. That's a really different way than most toy businesses do anything, right?
For sure.
Toy businesses are like the opposite of lean or agile.
Yeah.
They make all kinds of assumptions. They make all kinds of, you know, assessments of a market with very kind of, a lot of assumptions.
Yeah.
Think it's going to be great. And then kind of hope for the best and can do nothing about it because the thing then just lives in the world. Our approach is completely different. We see on a daily basis, on a weekly basis, how kids are using our content, our products, you know, where there's friction, what has high engagement, what has high retention. We can tweak and modify things and make the experience better and then learn from that so that when we're making new products, all of that learning goes into making even better products than we initially had.
Yeah, which is really cool. That's like taking a tech startup approach to toy development, which makes so much sense because like you're saying, like a normal toy company will just like build, they'll just produce a ton of it before they even really know it, and then just send it out and hope.
Yeah. And you know, that is the model. You know, most toy businesses produce, I don't know, like between 50 to 100 new things a year. Right. And as long as one of them sells like millions, they're okay with that. Yeah. Not all of them are going to, of course. I mean, they want them to, but that's never going to happen.
Yeah. Well, so that was something that just sort of came to my mind while you were talking about that is like, to, alongside the production side of things, so like when you're actually building the physical kits, in that sort of iterative thinking, do you produce more small batches or like how do you approach the manufacturing side?
So when we first started, we had a mini factory, basically just next door to our studio, and we produced everything in-house. Because we're a kit business, we could do that. They were, you know, not very complex at the beginning. They were, you know, pretty DIY at the beginning. And so we literally shipped everything from our mini factory. And what that gave us is was a really good sense and a closeness to the product, the process, and the manufacturing process. So when we did actually start to look for manufacturing partners, we really knew a lot about the time it took to kit something. So, we, you know, when people were giving us quotes, we could push back and be like, well, it takes us, you know, this, it takes us this amount of time and it costs us this in central London. How is it possible that it costs you that, you know, in wherever, you know, in, well, we did, we went to China, we went to Ireland, we went to lots of different places to look for different potential. So anyway, we started very, you know, integrated, and now we have a manufacturing partner in China that we've worked with for the last few years. And we actually have a new partner that we're onboarding right now to have a new, another partner in China that we'll be working with as well. So we now produce almost all of our products in China. But we've worked very closely with, you know, the factories to make sure when the standards are great and that the quality of what we're producing is as high as it possibly can be. And also to make sure that, you know, we have a partner that can work with us, through the process to meet, you know, we have very quick turnaround in terms of how we produce product, which is also different than most toy businesses. But we still have some capacity internally. So for example, for the subscription product, rather than just scaling it from the moment we launch it, we produce it internally. We can, you know, kind of scale it as we go. And right now we're looking for a manufacturing partner to help scale it to the next level.
Perfect. That's a great approach. I think that's really good. So I was just curious, like with your children, were you testing new product ideas on them or like experimenting with them? I'm sure that would have been part of the fun part. But
my oldest son is 8 years old now. So he's been like chief product tester since he was like four years old, I think. I mean, you know, he's made every single product. His friends have been on our boxes. He's had birthday parties that were literally pilots for new products. I'm not joking. he's a pretty like big part of what the business has gone through and the changes. And there's nothing like seeing something that your child loves or actually doesn't like that much to make you think about the products you're making. My youngest is only 10 months old, so he's still little. He's still little, but I'm sure he will be an inspiration for the new products that we make as he gets older. So,
Yeah, that's amazing. So now I want to sort of get to know you a little bit better and sort of talk about your past a bit more. So as you were saying, you studied in design, you have like background in education. Like what drew you to design sort of and that creative path? I guess you were saying your family is pretty creative, so that kind of drew you in that direction?
So I come from a really creative family. I've had, you know, architects and artists and photographers and my mom designer for a little while. My mom invented the game Operation when she worked for Milton Bradley.
That's so cool.
So, I mean, again, like I never, like this was not my plan. It really wasn't. I guess these things just happen. But so I came from a very creative family and when I was going to university, you know, I really loved kind of liberal arts, and I also loved art and design. And at the time, it was really hard to make a choice. Was I going to go to liberal arts school, or was I going to go to an art school?
Right.
And it felt like either way, I was like sacrificing one or the other.
Right.
And then I found this school called Rhode Island School of Design, which is in the East Coast in the US, which happens to be in the same location as Brown University.
Got it.
They had a program that was a kind of dual program of RISD and Brown. And that was just like the most amazing thing I could ever ask for, because I was able to get an amazing liberal arts degree and a liberal arts experience at the same time going to one of the most amazing art and design schools in the world, I think. I mean, RISD was amazing.
Right.
And while I was there, I learned about this practice called graphic design and explored it a bit more, and basically decided to major in graphic design and minored in art history. So I was really fascinated by art history. And while I was in the graphic design department, I think naturally, and maybe this is just how I am, I naturally didn't do what normal graphic designers do. Like, I was not really interested in posters and logos.
Right.
I was way more interested in interactive experiences and installations and sculpture. And so everything I did, and I was really interested in digital technology. So this is, you know, a long time ago.
Yeah.
The web was an ugly place at the time.
Yeah.
It was a really ugly place. And I was convinced that the web could be beautiful. And so I literally sought out, you know, who were the people making beautiful websites at the time? And I was like, I want to work for companies that make beautiful things in the digital space. And so, you know, I think my entire senior year, I took only sculpture classes, and I did like pretty much interactive installations using projectors and all kinds of different technologies. So I guess my design and art kind of background just really fueled kind of where I am today.
Yeah.
And then, as I mentioned, I did a master's in responsibility and business practice, which was obviously completely different than that program. But I still managed to bring a lot of my creativity and my interest in design and art into all of the activities I did during my master's program as well. So it definitely it is just how I do things in the world.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, it's nothing else.
Yeah, for sure. Like, so where's your family like originally from? Like, where based?
Mm-hmm. So I was born in Los Angeles.
Oh,
my family's in California.
Yeah.
And I moved to the East Coast when I went to university, and I lived in New York for a few years. And then I moved to Italy. I went to a program called Fabrica, which is a creative research center that's funded by the Benetton family.
Oh, cool.
It's a really amazing kind of residency program, I guess you could call it. And that is where I met my husband. So my husband went to Fabrica. He wasn't my husband at the time.
Yeah.
My husband went to Fabrica to start the physical computing department. So his background is in physical computing. So that's where my life as you know it started in Italy. And then we decided to move to London. And that's where, you know, we didn't come here to start a business. It just so happened that that's what we did.
When you started Tech Will Save Us, did you feel prepared for the challenges of running a company? Like, what was sort of running through your mind when you were starting this business?
I mean, maybe if you've like done an MBA and gone to business school, but even then, I don't know if you're actually prepared. It's such an emotional experience. I think more so than maybe anyone, you know, everyone can tell you it is, but until you're in it, you just don't know. Absolutely 100% was not prepared for any of the things. But I do think, and I do think about this a lot. I think being an entrepreneur has made me a better person. I have gained so much knowledge and so much humility and so many skills and so many tools and a completely different mindset, because I've chosen to use that journey as a way of growing as a person and growing as a creator and growing as a leader and growing as a, you know, as a mom and as just a person. But that was definitely a choice, because, you know, becoming an entrepreneur could also totally destroy you. You can just literally go crazy or have a, you know, nervous breakdown or become a hedonist and a total, you know, megalomaniac. I mean, there's all kinds of pathways you could come, but I've really chosen for it to ground me and to help me to grow as the kind of person I want to be. And I feel really confident that it has. And I'm really proud of what we've done and proud of all the hard stuff we've had to go through, because I think it's made us all better. And I'm really proud of the teams that we've worked with that, you know, are no longer with us and that are doing amazing things in the world. And some that are still with us that have been with us for a long time, and some that have just joined that are, you know, doing things that I never imagined we could do. So I think that's also pretty incredible.
Yeah, no, that's very exciting. One thing I wanted to sort of get back to is,
that was part one of my interview with Bethany. Follow me on social media and wherever you listen to podcasts to make sure you get the next episode. We talk about how she handles life as a CEO, how being creative has been an advantage, and her advice for other creatives. See you next time.